It's been 25 years since Anna Quinlan created her columns in the New York Times. Now, several bestsellers, a Pulitzer Prize, and a grown set of children later, she has decided to reflect on all that she's learned about life, marriage, and parenting, friendship, and faith in a new memoir she has called Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Anna Quinlan back to our show. Hi.
Hi. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Now, you've called the introduction to your book Life in the 50s. You did a column in the Times called Life in the 30s?
Exactly. And over the years, people would sidle up to me and say, will we ever see life in the 30s again? And I'd say, well, maybe you will, but I won't because now I'm in my 40s and 50s.
But the 40s are the lost years. You didn't write anything about that.
Well, I was writing an op-ed page column during part of that time for the Times, and I was writing one for Newsweek after part of that time, too. So I feel like I have been more adequately chronicled than almost any writer in America.
Well, I remember seeing you on a TV talk show around the time you decided to stop writing the op-ed column in the Times, and the host of the show seemed dumbfounded that you'd be willing to give up such an important platform to devote yourself to writing fiction and bringing up a family. You seem to be surprised that he was surprised, but was that a concern for you at the time?
Not in the least, but it was really interesting for me. I mean, the Times ran a piece saying I was giving up my op-ed page column to write novels. And I think I was about 3 months out, and I was standing on the IRT platform, and the motorman leaned out of the window and said to me, how's retirement? And I realized that no one thinks of writing fiction as a full-time job, when in fact it is, especially if you have three kids under the age of whatever they were then.
But still, there must have been days when you wished that you could suddenly call the Times and say, you know, I have this thing I really feel very strongly about. Can I have a column today?
You know, honestly, there isn't. There's a kind of an on-off switch to being a columnist. When you're one, you consume news and observe the world with a completely different lens. And when you turn that off and you're doing that as a civilian, there's a whole lot of ground between one and the other that you're not covering every day, and you kind of get out of the habit.
In other words, you see something, a newspaper article, and you think, okay, this could be the subject of my next op-ed column. You don't have to do that anymore.
Exactly. You don't have to do anything
you
with
have
the
to
news.
Say, what are my thoughts about Trayvon Martin?
No, I remember at one point, maybe it was one of the kids or my husband said, that's the first time I've ever watched you watch the State of the Union without a notebook on your lap. And the truth is, you just become an ordinary interested consumer of news.
But then you started writing the column for Newsweek.
I did. I didn't intend to ever go back to column writing, in part because it was really hard to combine it with fiction writing. But the Newsweek column was every other week. And it made a really nice rhythm to my life that I had a column week and a novel week.
And a lot has changed for you since you started the column. You say you now feel more galvanized as a person.
I just find, and I find from talking to other people that they agree with me, that there's something about getting to this point in our lives. I'll be 60 in a couple of months, where you feel as though you've gotten to some place you were meant to be, that you were learning all the time how to be human, and now you finally got the lesson and passed the exams.
Well, you say that during the arc of your life, quote, first I was who I was, then I didn't know who I was, then I invented someone and became her, then I began to like what I'd invented, and finally I was what I was again. The persona is the person who writes that column and who has a certain perspective on the world. You become the person you invent.
I think there's some truth to that, but I also think you circle back. I've thought a lot about what I might have been like at 5 or 6. I can't remember much about her except that the perhaps apocryphal stories of my family are that she was kind of out of control. And I think about how the one thing I do know, having had 5 and 6 year olds, is that they don't give a rip what anybody thinks about who they are or what they do. And I think there's something about reaching a certain point in your life where suddenly you think, to quote kids, I am the boss of me now. And that has less to do with that persona you've invented than with your authentic self coming to the fore again.
But kids can do a painting and make the sky orange and the grass purple. And then people tell them, well, no, the sky's blue and the grass is green. And eventually they start conforming.
Exactly. And also we sort of blunt their imagination. When they say that something is a dragon, we say, well, that's kind of like a dragon, honey, but it's really called a chameleon or something, as opposed to just going with the imagination. And if you're lucky enough to have a certain kind of kid, which I did, they foil your attempts to blunt their imagination and keep it with them.
Thinking back to some of the positives, you suggest that you might have been hired by the Times because there had been a lawsuit about the lack of women at the paper. You'd already established yourself as a journalist. Did you feel that way at the time, or is this something that you've come to think about later in life?
I didn't feel that way initially. I was quite convinced at 24 that I was the best little girl reporter in New York City.
You've been at the Post.
I was at the New York Post, right. And it took me about 6 months to find out that women had brought a class action suit against the New York Times. And I don't suggest that I was hired because of that. I was hired because of that. The New York Times was not in the habit of hiring 24-year-old young women who had worked on tabloids.
So does that taint the success you had at the Times?
Only if you can't cut the mustard, and luckily the mustard and I are good friends.
You write that you and your friends' lives were very different from that of your mother's as heiresses to a women's movement. Did your decision to be a mother and a writer affect the way that you went about dealing with both parts of your life?
Well, I think in some ways it made it easier for me. I remember once writing a Life in the 30s column about how my ambition had been blunted since I'd had kids, and so I was only writing part-time at home. And one nice woman, who I believe was a doctor, wrote me a letter and said, in effect, God save me from writers who congratulate themselves on how they can combine work and family. Mm-hmm. The truth is, you know, I didn't have clients. I didn't have patients. I got to sit at home in front of a computer and natter away. And that made that balance much easier than it might have been otherwise.
But you say many women who made the same family and professional choices as you were reluctant to express feelings that they felt overwhelmed.
Well, that still goes on. I mean, this whole ridiculous faux controversy that we had about the comments of Hillary Rosen saying that Ann Romney had never worked a day in her life is all about women saying, well, I can be anything I want, but what I want is to stay home full time and take care of these kids, and people are going to pass judgment on that. Or conversely, I can be anything I want, but I'm not home full-time taking care of my kids, and people are going to pass judgment on that.
And there are more complications there, too. Some women are at home because they can afford to be at home. Others have to go to work whether they want to or not. And then there are other women who just can't imagine not going out to work because they would feel that their lives were unfulfilled.
But I think being female at some level in America, maybe in all countries, is about judgment from the outside. So, for example, we trash poor women who won't go outside the home to earn a living as welfare moms, and we trash rich women who do as latchkey moms. And over again, you say to yourself, can we talk about the dads in here? But it's been couple decades of doing this for me, and so far that hasn't happened.
So you were writing about these things. Do you think that you paved the way for the mommy blogger genre?
A couple of mommy bloggers have said that, and I feel very, very complimented by that. I mean, there's no doubt that when I was doing Life in the 30s, it felt like a kind of a new form, writing this kind of intensely personal column about being a young mother in, of all places, the New York Times.
My guest is Anna Quinlan, who's written a memoir called Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. It is published by Random House. Your generation is also, once again, in a unique position. You call it the sandwich generation.
Well, by the numbers, more of us, say, at age 60, have living parents than any other generation in history.
And then you have grown children.
And more of us also have grown children who may be dependent in one way or another, either financially or actually living with us, than at any generation in history. So, as I say, a whole generation of women who were raised to believe they could be more than caretakers are now caretakers at both ends of the spectrum.
Now that your children are adults, you talk to them about what happened when they were younger. Russ Chast says that when she goes to do her cartoons, she puts her coat on, leaves the house, and then goes upstairs through a back door. But the kids think that she has left to go to the office. That was the only way she'd get her work done. Your kids can actually read the columns you wrote over those years. Did they?
Occasionally they would. I mean, a story would come up and I would say, oh, that story is in the column I wrote about sibling rivalry. And one or both of the two siblings involved would go back and look at it. But, you know, what your mom does, whether she's Secretary of State or a secretary in an office, just doesn't have that much resonance for you. And I think it includes whether your mom wrote about you or not.
Unless your mom is Judy Garland or something like that.
Yeah, I guess. But maybe that's not such a good model for what you want your mom to be long term.
Now, why did you devote a section of your book to stuff, the things that you've accumulated over your lifetime?
Because I do think that we went through a period when people really became maniacal consumers in the United States. And there was a sense in which it was going to sort of feed us. It was going to soothe our souls. And because of the economic downturn, we woke up one morning and thought, what were we thinking? And I love what were we thinking moments.
Well, a part of your collection is nun paraphernalia.
Well, the nun paraphernalia, I'm not getting rid of. My second son is a little left of center in every conceivable way. He knows I was educated by nuns. At a certain point, he bought me a fighting nun puppet, which I absolutely loved. And ever since, whenever he sees a good piece of nun paraphernalia, he gets it. So I have a pretty extensive collection.
Do you feel kind of protective of the nuns these days, since they've been criticized by the Vatican?
I feel like the Vatican is so full of it. I mean, nuns are doing the great work of the Catholic Church in terms of social welfare. They always have and they always will. And they should be left in peace to do that work.
You say that you once thought the look of your home revealed whether you had a happy family, but you've changed your mind. Those embroidered samplers don't really reveal all that much?
I used to think that if everything matched and there were table lamps and everything, that somehow that indicated a kind of a serenity that I should have known better about, and that in fact over the years I've learned doesn't exist in many of those carefully ordered households.
So you're decluttering now, except for the nun paraphernalia?
Well, every time I suggest I'm decluttering, I can hear either in fact or in my head the voices of my three children mocking me. So I'm not going to say that. I am going to say I am inclined to declutter.
You write about family and marriage, and one of the more controversial lines that you have in this book is, a safety net of small white lies can be the bedrock of a successful marriage.
I don't understand why that's controversial.
Well, because people feel you shouldn't lie. White lies or other kinds. What kind of white lies are we talking about
here? You know, what things cost and how much you weigh and, you know, whether you like certain friends that your husband wants to have dinner with, and, you know, whether you like that tie. I mean, all the little stuff that you don't want. You have to pick your fights. In marriage, in child rearing, you have to pick your fights. In the same way that I'm not going to fight with my kids about their hair or their clothes, or didn't. Now they're too old to be bothered by
my opinion.
So you
let your kids choose what they were going to wear when they were young? Because they always choose the most ridiculous thing.
No, when they were really, really young, I didn't. Because, you know, we could be wearing a bathing suit in January. There was a long period of time during which Maria wore a tutu pretty incessantly. But, you know, the whole, oh, you know, those horrible jeans with the this and the that. I mean, it's the earth just does not revolve around that.
You're right that younger women often ask you for advice. Is that something you think about more now that your daughter Maria is 22?
Well, Maria is more inclined to ask me for advice now, which is a wonderful feeling after living through the years where her operative mode towards me was rolling her eyes and making a clicking noise with her tongue.
So what do you think happens? 22, they suddenly realize that maybe you weren't the most stupid person on earth?
I think they just grow up. I mean, I the great thing about raising teenagers for me was that I had a visceral recollection of what it was like to be a teenager. And that really helped a lot. If you don't remember what that period's like, you're doomed.
In a Wall Street Journal piece, you reveal something that surprised yourself, that you hate to write and often find it a chore. And yet, you've written an awful lot. So what do you do? Is it just a scratch that you have to – I mean, an itch that you have to scratch or
no,
force yourself?
It's the only thing I know how to do to begin with. There are people to whom I am under contract, but I always despair of writing anything good, and I hate to revisit my own work in print because all I can see is what's wrong with it.
So what happens when you have to do a reading? Do you just keep on changing the words?
No. I do it, but I try not to think too much about what I'm reading because doing the audio book is a nightmare.
And you will be doing a reading, in fact. Anna Quinlan will be doing a reading and signing books tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street and Broadway. The book is called Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, a memoir. It's published by Random House. When you do the readings, do people come up to you and say, you changed my life?
Some people come up and say some variation on that, yeah. It's really humbling.
Well, do you feel a kinship with all of those readers with whom you've essentially aged?
I do. I mean, women come up to me and say, so the kids are 28, 26, and 23. And then I know that they were tracking during life in the 30s and their kids were the exact same age.
Are you working on another novel?
I am. I'm about 70 pages into another novel.
70 pages. So.
Well, I'm not sure what that means, Leonard, because I now use a font so large that you can read it from space. So
16 point, right. Thank you so much for being on our show again, Anna.
It's a pleasure.